Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Larimer, as usual, and I am joined today by Mr. Marius Root. Marius, how are you doing, sir?
I'm all right, and you, Nick?
I'm all right. I'm getting there. I'm surviving, as the kids say. And we are, of course, once again joined by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. I'm resisting the temptation to speak about, you know, birth rates, population sizes, and economic growth. So I will stand strong and commit to staying on topic.
You know, there's very long podcasts we could do about on other interesting topics like that. And Herman is referring to a discussion going on our comments section right now. But we must get to the news of the day. So let me, of course, start off with our first story for today. And this is, I don't know whether to call it, this is the source of much joy and much pain for Marius Root. And, of course, that is South Africa's cricket team. Surprise, surprise, it continues to be in a bit of chaos, with the latest being that the deputy coach of the South African cricket team, or the Proteas assistant coach, I think is his official name, Enoch Nkwe, has resigned from the cricket side, saying that there are lots of issues with the internal culture. At the same time, former cricket player for South Africa, Mark Boucher, who's currently the head coach, has been attacked for allegedly enabling an environment of kind of racist bullying and name-calling and all sorts of other things in the Proteas, and he sort of gave an apology, sort of, but it was a very sort of playing both sides kind of apology. He said, oh, if I had accidentally offended anyone, then I'm sorry, but at the same time, I'm working hard to, I don't know, increase wokeness in the team or whatever. Anyway, I'm paraphrasing. Point is, things are not looking great in the Proteas. Marius, kind of, what's going on? Am I missing anything? And why is this continuing to happen? I mean, all of our sports have problems, but why is cricket just so in trouble?
It's hard to say. It's probably an issue of leadership. And there's one thing about Enoch Nkwe. He went to the same school as you, Nick. He's a St. Stithers boy. But but I mean, there definitely seems to be some kind of issue.
There's Kagiso Rabada as well.
Yes, correct. Yeah. So there's definitely some sort of issue there. He's resigned, and he's in his resignation letter, he said he felt he wasn't being given the respect he deserved, and he was basically demoted to being a cones boy, which I suppose means he was just, you know, putting out the cones for fielding drills, and, you know, his input wasn't really, nobody really listened to his inputs and so on. And look, I mean, it's hard to say what the real story is as an outsider, but I mean, there's no smoke without fire. And Mark Boucher, even in his kind of apology letter, says, you know, when guys came into the Proteas in the 90s, they didn't really have any kind of, you know, cultural coaching, for better word, for better term. And, you know, the guys would have been, they're professional sportsmen. They're probably not too aware of the, you know, kind of cultural issues outside the team, political issues and what have you. So one of the things that Mark Boucher was criticized for was there was a team song that they used to sing when the Proteas won a game. And the contemporary of Mark Boucher was a guy called Paul Adams, coloured spinner from the Western Cape, who's now also got into coaching and so on. And they used to sing a song about him, calling him a brown shit, which, you know, it's obviously not great. You could, you know, dismiss it as, no, it's just banter, whatever the case is. But you also, given the history of the country and so on, it's a bit, you know, you're probably going around calling people brown shits and whatever. And it's obviously something that still bothers Paul Adams. He's speaking about it now 20 years later. So it's obviously an issue. And they've also been, Enoch Nkwe was the interim coach of South Africa after Otis Gibson resigned in 2019. And then a lot of people thought he'd get the job, but Mark Boucher was given the job and a lot of people think he was given the job because his old friend and former captain, Graham Smith, was the director of cricket for CSA at that time. So there's obviously something going on. That also said, a lot of the stuff does get overblown. I remember Makai Antini was saying that, you know, he was always excluded from the team, and, you know, he felt he thought it was really unfair that he was dropped when he was dropped, because he wanted to go get the record for the most test wickets for South Africa. But and he also claimed he wasn't given a contract when he at the end of his career for one more season. But I mean, if you look at the stats, Mokantini, when he was dropped, it was right to drop him. He wasn't performing. He's one of the greatest cricketers ever played for South Africa. But at the end of the career, was right to drop him. His average was averaging about 40 odd for wickets, which is not good enough for one of your strike bowlers. And also, if you go look at contemporary reports from when he retired, 2011, 2012. He was given a contract when he says he wasn't given a contract for one more season. And he thanks people like Sean Pollock and Dr. Ali Bacha for all they've done for him through his career. Surely somebody, if they'd been excluded, he wouldn't be thanking people who'd been at the top of South African crickets. And also one more thing with Mokantini, he was convicted of rape in 1999. But what happened was Cricket South Africa stood by him. They paid for his legal fees and so on, and he was acquitted on appeal. So obviously that's all good. There was obviously... the first conviction was wrong and whatever. Mokantini is free to go on with his life. But somebody, you know, if it was somebody that wasn't going to be supported because of his race or whatever, I doubt Cricket South Africa would have stood up for him like they did against his rape conviction. And, so a lot of this, you also, you know, what is the true story? But I think with the issue with Enoch Nkwe, like, it does sound like there is a lot of unhappiness within the team. And I don't think Enoch Nkwe is, over-exaggerating or anything. But it's definitely something that we need to look at. And if South African cricket wants to be successful, they've got to find a way of, you know, creating an inclusive culture within the team, getting people of different cultures and backgrounds to work together. I think Rassie Erasmus and Siya Kolisi at the Springboks is an excellent example of that. We've seen, I mean, Rassie Erasmus is, you know, an Afrikaans guy from Dispatch. Siya Kolisi is from a township in Port Elizabeth. But they managed to come together from very different backgrounds to build the best team in the world. And that team is also made up of people from very different backgrounds. I mean, Makazola Mapimpi is a very different person from Franco Mostad, for example. But they're working together to create one of the best Springbok teams that has ever actually played. And it shows you what can happen when South Africans decide to work together. And we put aside our differences of race and culture and language and work together towards a common goal. I mean, it's a bit trite to point the Springboks as, you know, a sign of South African success. But I think it does show you what can happen when people put aside their differences, which are there, but put them aside for a common goal.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is an example of South African success, the Springboks, most of the time. So, Maurice, just before I go to you, Herman, I just, this impression, so I'm really not particularly clued up on the internal dynamics of Cricket South Africa. But it seems to me here that there's always been this kind of perception of there being a sort of tight, sort of buddy old boys club of a couple of players who've kind of dominated and controlled the thing from inside, and they've created maybe a little bit of a toxic culture. And then when you combine to that all of the sort of toxic politics around transformation and that kind of stuff to the team as well, these two things when they interact with each other have created this environment. Is that a completely off base, or do you think there's something to that?
No, I think so. And as you say, there was a kind of a clique that controlled the team. Nobody's really said who it was, but it seems it was people like Graham Smith, Jacques Kallis, Mark Boucher, and other players like Herschel Gibbs have also come out and complained about it. And Herschel Gibbs is also one of our greatest players, but he seems to have been a bit of an outsider when he was playing for the Proteas. I mean, it might be neither here nor there, but he's also a coloured guy, if you want to use, you know, that kind of... language or whatever. So I don't know if that's part of it. And maybe with Mark Boucher, Mark Boucher has been pretty successful as a coach at domestic level. He did pretty well with the Titans. But, you know, maybe he's not the easiest guy to work with. And maybe this kind of toxic culture, as you mentioned, there was in the Proteas when Mark Boucher was part of the team, has now maybe been taken to the Proteas again with him as head coach. But obviously, I mean, this is all speculation as somebody who's a complete outsider and just really loves the game and cares about it. But I mean, I think this isn't good for South African cricket, and we've just landed in Sri Lanka for a series against that team. But Enoch Nkwe, I mean, resigned 2 days ago or whatever it is, so it's not really good for the stability of the team when your deputy coach leaves. And I mean, we've got a big season coming up. We've got the T20 World Cup in October. We've got India, who's, I mean, they're not doing very well in the current test match, but one of the best test teams in the world, coming to South Africa at the end of the year. So, yeah, we've got a big season coming up, and the thing is, I mean, fish rots from its head. And if these issues at CSA and in the management of the side is going to filter down to the Proteas, and then it'll filter down to the domestic scene and what have you. And one more thing, kids don't want to play a game that's that they support teams that win. And if the Proteas aren't winning, that's going to be bad for cricket as a whole. People support teams that win and want to play sports where the national teams are winning. So, I mean, maybe that's not true because a lot of people still like soccer and the Bafana is a pretty bad team. But I think if there are these kinds of issues around the Proteas, I do think that affects cricket as a whole in the country.
Bafana is fueled by an enormous amount of hope. I think it's the most optimistic man of the world is probably a Bafana fan. Anyway.
Just to say one more thing. I think Bafana is a very good microcosm of South Africa, where in the late 90s and early 2000s was making World Cups, was beating the big teams. And South Africa is also, look at this rising country. The economy is growing really quickly. Things are going well. Now Bafana's, I don't know, ranked 80th in the world or whatever. We can't even qualify for the African Cup of Nations, then won the World Cup. And I think it's kind of a reflection on South Africa as a whole.
Mm. Herman, your thoughts on all of this and particularly the politics around it?
Yeah, so I can't add anything to what Marius has said about, he said it all in terms of the actual game. I do think, however, I can't help thinking that if you really want to solve problems like this, you don't give cover to possible racists by insisting that some people are in the team, not because they're good cricketers and can be trusted to represent the country, but only because of the color of their skin. I think if you want to rebuild trust in South African sport broadly and cricket specifically, you do need to take a leaf from Kulisi and Rassie Erasmus's book, where you make it clear that what's important here is the sport. And if you're in the team, it means you belong there. Because if there was this clique less than savory, unpleasant characters, the best way to shut them up would to make it absolutely clear that if you're in the Proteas team, it's because you're the best man for the job, not that you're some political insertion to represent, I don't know, a political agenda. If you really want to disarm racists on all sides, you just get the game to be about the game, because then I think the weight of your presence in a team is no longer something that can be disputed. You can't be made off as just, some box ticking exercise. If you're in the team, you're in the team, and the team should accept you. So I do think that it's easy to talk along these lines. But if you want to rebuild trust in sport between the citizen and the national team, and the national team in and of itself, you do need to make it about the best people for the job. And if you're the person saying that black people can't be selected on merit because for some mysterious reason black people don't merit the highest performance, then I think you've got some significant problems that you need to figure out for yourself.
All right, let us move on from cricket to a unprecedented story in South Africa, which is the first time a judge is impeached in South Africa's history. And this is, of course, the very controversial judge, John Hlophe, who is the judge president of the Western Cape. The Judicial Service Commission has now recommended that he should be impeached and has submitted this to Parliament to decide. So there is going to be a vote held in Parliament as to whether he should retain his position as a judge or whether he should be chucked out of the judiciary. It seems like it's quite a test, I think, for the integrity of the country's judiciary. John Hlophe is definitely not aligned with the current ruling faction in the ANC. He's not a Cyril guy. So I think that definitely increases the chances that he's going to be impeached by Parliament. Herman, could you take us through a little bit about what you understand about this decision? Is this a big deal? And what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I mean, this thing was really a decade or more in the making. It stems from the fact that two constitutional court justices in 2008-09-ish, I think it was Justice Nkabinde and was it Yafta? I can't remember the other guy. Well, the other judge, the justice, yeah, Justices Basin Kabinde and Chris Yafta, said they were approached by Judge President John Klope about, you know, with a vernacular, with a rhetoric that we can rely on you. We, you know, the movement, the ANC, the government, the ruling faction, the president's men can rely on you guys to win this arms deal involvement corruption case in which Zuma was implicated. When that comes before the highest court, we, the movement, can rely on your loyalty to carry him through. These justices, to their credit, considered this to be way out of line, brought you know, these complaints and reported it to the relevant authorities. And now, for almost a decade, for more than a decade, no action has been taken on this issue. So I think, Nick, on your introductory points, I think it's very, very important to realize that while this is a constitutional process of accountability, a constitutional mechanism of accountability kicking in, the first judge in South Africa to go through this impeachment process, we should be, and while that's all good and well, the system is functioning, we should be under no illusion that this is some sort of moral victory. This is politics as its most brutal, pragmatic form. When it didn't suit the ANC that Jacob Zuma was president, they got rid of him. When it didn't suit the ruling powers that be that Ace Magashule was being an impediment to the progress of factional interests, they acted against him. So it's a cynical, but I think represent relatively accurate way of looking at this, that this isn't a moral victory for the Constitution. Yes, it's good that a constitutional accountability mechanism is kicking in, but we shouldn't go gaga for this thing as now being a new generation or a new era of accountability when it is clear politics. And the reason I say that is, yes, to seek to influence the High Court, the highest court in the land by Justice Lopez, I think, quite disgusting. But let's consider some other things that the same man did and faced no consequences for. In 2005, it was reported that Schlope assigned a case about Afrikaans language rights to Judge Wilfred Tring. And I quote, because I knew he would fuck up the trial and then it could be set right on appeal. So this was apparently said before several witnesses. Chlope made this off as a smear campaign. In 2005, he called a Cape Town attorney a piece of white shit who is not fit to walk in the corridors of the High Court and that he should go back to Holland. So when we see this sort of accountability mechanism kicking in constitutionally, we can be glad that these mechanisms are available and that, you know, they might work in this historic instance. But we shouldn't bluff ourselves into thinking that this is somehow a moral victory when it is really just dirty politics. John Klope is, I now need to be careful in case I ever want to practice law. John Klope is, with all due respect, a piece of utter judicial excrement that does not belong on the bench. I think my phraseology saved me there from contempt, but he does not belong on the South African bench. He is not a fit and proper person. He should not be in that position of power, but for many reasons. And it's good that we're getting rid of him, but let's not delude ourselves into thinking that this is some moral progress by reforming hand of God through acting through President Ramaphosa. This is cynical politics, and I mean, what else do you expect from the Judicial Services Commission?
I'm going to tell my grandchildren that I was there when Herman destroyed his future chances of a legal career. Marius, Anything to add to what Herman has said? Do you agree that we should not take this too seriously in terms of the sort of constitutional precedent it will set, but that it's still a good thing nonetheless?
Yeah, it's obviously a good thing, but I mean, as Herman correctly points out, this is, I mean, Klopp has been doing this kind of thing for years and years and years. But I think one thing that will be interesting to watch is that, as far as I know, he's going to be impeached in Parliament. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of, you know, that will the ANC come out? Will all 230 ANC MPs come vote against Klopp, or will they become kind of some kind of factional split, or whatever the case is? And I'm pretty sure the ANC can rely on all 81, I think it's 81 DA MPs will vote for impeachment, probably ACDP code, Freedom Front Plus. They need about 267 votes. So, I mean, you'll need the ANC. You won't even need the whole ANC. I mean, you'll need what's about 160 of their MPs or so, or maybe a bit more, 170, whatever the case is. But yeah, so I mean, I think that'll be interesting to watch, and they'll tell you what kind of grip President Ramaphosa has on his party. I mean, if only half the guys rock up to vote against Klopp, that's going to tell you something. But if all 230 are off and they vote against Klopp, then it'll tell you probably President Ramaphosa is starting to, you know, get the party under control.
Yeah, no, I think that's pretty much correct. I think it would be a very good thing to see him impeached. And let's hope that indeed it does happen. Right, let us move on for some lighter items for the end of our show for the week. And of course, the first one is, what if the ANC was a company? It would have been shut. The government would have marched to its offices and burned it down years ago for the way it treats its workers. The staff of the ANC have decided to go on what the ANC has described as a wildcat strike, because they say they have not been paid in 2 or 3 months. This story was a little bit, some of the details are a little bit confusing, but it seems to be that for around 3 months, staff have not been paid on time in the ANC offices. They are, and this comes after they were still waiting for their salaries from July 2021, and the ANC sent a message to all of their staff saying, quote, "Unfortunately, August 2021 salaries due on the 25th of this month are also delayed." The general manager of the ANC said that he does regret the hardship and uncertainty that this causes the staff and their families, and that this is deeply regrettable. Well, this is perhaps one of the reasons why their list was quite difficult to put together, because apparently their staff is just fed up and are now on strike. Floyd Shivambu, the deputy leader of the EFF, tweeted, "Wildcat strike. Workers are not paid for 3 months, and a dismissive reaction from the dying organization is to characterize workers' legitimate demands as a wildcat strike. They must close their offices forever." Morris, the ANC blames the newly passed Political Funding Party Funding Act for this problem. Do you think that that's really what it's to do with?
I think it's definitely part of it, but it's also, the ANC obviously can't even run a bath, never mind quite a big political party, never mind, quite a sophisticated country. So I think it just shows you, and I mean, just the hypocrisy, as you say, the ANC, if there was some business somewhere that hadn't paid their guys for 2 or 3 months, the ANC would be losing their minds and talking about why monopoly capital and how evil it is and what have you. But the ANC just, you know, blasé, like, yeah, we're not going to pay you guys. And you really can't blame these people for going on this wildcat strike. I mean, you know, you can't really, you haven't been paid for 3 months. But it's also, I mean, it's a microcosm of, I mean, there's state-owned companies where people haven't been paid for months. You know, there's mines that have been taken over by BE or tenderpreneurs that have been linked to the ANC. I think it was Kulabuse Zuma, I might be wrong, but it was definitely one of Jacob Zuma's nephews, and I think a grandson of Nelson Mandela, who were basically given a mine. People didn't get paid for up to a year. I think there were stories of people drinking and eating rat poison because they couldn't pay their bills anymore. They couldn't see a way out. You know, so obviously, I mean, hopefully the people who vote for the ANC don't, I mean, sorry, not vote, people who work for the ANC don't go do something as drastic as that. But it shows you also, the ANC talks all about how progressive it is and how it cares about the workers. but it holds in absolute contempt because, I mean, how do you not pay people 3 months and expect them to work? It's absolutely disgusting. These people have probably had to go into debt and all kinds of things, you know, just to pay their monthly bills or just get to work, and they're not getting paid for it. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what kind of state the ANC lists are in for the upcoming local government election. And I mean, I'm not sure I've said it on this show, but I've definitely said it elsewhere that, you know, you've got to ask yourself why the ANC was keen for an election in May when it appeared before the Mosideki Commission. And now suddenly it says, no, well, let's postpone the election. So I think that it's probably maybe the admin in such a mess. And I think another issue is they probably saw some good opinion polling, which said they're probably going to get a very bloody nose at the next election. That's why they're keen to postpone it.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much right. It is quite shocking. And of course, I think I can't remember which of us has pointed it out before. It's not my idea. I'm stealing it from someone else at the Institute. But government is very insistent on forcing minimum wages and such for businesses in this country. But when it comes to the expanded public works program, which is, of course, a sort of, you know, entry level work experience jobs program using taxpayer money, the government is perfectly happy to pay people less than minimum wage in that circumstance. It's the ANC lives out in practice, do as I say, not do as I do.
I think they pay people $500 a day, I think. I mean, $100 a day, I think. In the
Herman, thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, I must say it sort of, I am tempted to feel pity for people who work for the ANC. And I might even genuinely do, but I can't quite get over the notion that the ANC is actually nothing but a get rich quick scheme, a gangster organization, a parasite, and people who voluntarily go into that.
Apparently, it's not a get rich quick scheme for quite a few of the people.
Yes. I wonder whether this sort of bizarre, perhaps, you know, unkind Schadenfreude I'm feeling is when you see, you know, a criminal get their comeuppance, or, you know, I don't know, the Tom and Jerry, you know, Tom getting hit in the face by a rake. But there's some element of me that thinks that you cannot expect the ANC to actually function. I can't see genuine ideological reasons to be part of it. I mean, that perhaps just my perception on it, that I have a blind spot there, but I can't imagine those people have honorable intentions working for the ANC. I can't imagine that. I can't just imagine myself there. But I think one thing here that is quite clear is, and we saw that, and this is perhaps going to get the bobillon after the berg a bit, but the ANC's talent pool is, you know, dry. Bone dry. I mean, they have no skills left in the organization at all. I mean, if you think about
it, because who would work for an organization that doesn't pay you for 3 months?
Yes, and also the fact is, you know, say what you will of Mbeki and so on, and the arms deal. At least, you know, they had the foresight to, if there was, you know, if they, to at least pay the henchmen. Going out to break the knuckles of whoever they needed to break. So it really takes a special type of incompetence to be this bad running essentially a monopoly gangster state. But it does sort of reflect the reality that Thabo Mbeki, Jacob Zuma, Halema Motlanthe, Cyril Ramaphosa, Skhosana Dlamini Zuma, these are all people from the exact same generation of ANC cohorts. There's no new generation of ANC leadership. There's no new intake of talent. And this is relevant to the story in two ways. Number one, if there were people with some skills in the party, at least you could avoid the party not being able to pay its workers. I mean, the DA has been under immense financial strain. It has not done this. It has cut jobs, it has retrenched, but my goodness, it has at least followed the basic labor relations of this country for all its other ills. So on the one hand, it speaks of clear incompetence in just simple management of human resources. And then on the other side, it explains why they have no competence left, because there's so little left to steal you can't even be sure of your cut. So why take the gamble and you know, if you are competent in some way, throw your lot in with such a zombie of a political organization? So, well, yeah, before I get too, you know, just resentful of ANC supporters, I'll just call it a day there.
Very good. Anyway, that is all that we have time for today. I mean, I do see someone in the comments wants to buy you a pint if you visit London. So when you do finally visit London to see the House of Lords, I think you should perhaps take.
What do you mean, see the House of Lords? I would say to go sit in it and make my maiden speech.
We hope that it's one day is so. Anyway, thank you very much.
Yes, I shall reverse. I shall reverse the 1960 referendum result.
Let it never be said that we don't come up with novel takes on things. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please support the IRR, the Daily Friend, and this show. And yeah, have a wonderful weekend. We'll see you next week. Cheers, everyone.